Robin Hood Radio and the Robin Hood Radio Network is proud to present Leonard Lopate at Large, lively hour-long in-depth discussions providing overviews and context to topics usually covered in partial measures. His guests include leading thinkers, scientists, artists, economists, farmers, historians, authors, and politicians. Mr. Lopate is a Peabody Award winner whose numerous honors include 3 Associated Press Awards and 3 James Beard Awards.
Welcome to Leonard Lopate at Large. I'm Leonard Lopate. Stephen Schwartz was just 21 when his song Butterflies Are Free was performed on a Broadway stage, and 7 years later he had 3 shows running concurrently on Broadway, Godspell, Pippin, and The Magic Show. Songs for a number of hit movies followed, and then another big Broadway hit, Wicked, which opened in 2003 and is still going strong 15 years later. Along the way, he's won a Drama Desk Award, 3 Grammys, 3 Oscars, and a special Tony Award in 2015 for his commitment for serving artists and fostering new talent. In 2008, Carol DeGeer charted the career of this remarkable composer and lyricist in a biography named after one of Mr. Schwartz's most popular songs. Defying Gravity has just been published in an updated version by Applause Theater and Cinema Books, and I'm very pleased that it brings Carol DeGeer and Stephen Schwartz to our show now. Welcome.
Thank you. And it's actually DeGeer.
Oh, I'm sorry.
It's very French.
Oh. French. Well, Carol, I got that name right. How did you become involved writing a biography of Stephen? Had you been a fan?
No, actually. I grew up liking musicals. My mother had a lot of the albums, like South Pacific and King and I, so I enjoyed them. But I had just finished a writing degree some years earlier, and I was just doing little projects, but I ended up on a freelance project. We were all supposed to go out on the internet, a bunch of writers, and find musicians' information, and we were assigned different letters of the alphabet, and I was actually assigned S.
And you had
and
a double S here.
I discovered StephenSchwartz.com, and I'd been looking for a big project, and I was really interested in his work that I found there, and it just felt fascinating. He had some information about how he writes musicals, so I wanted to explore it further.
And did you have to approach him for authorization?
He had his contact information there, and so I emailed him, and he wrote back. I said, could I write a book about you? And he said, no one to date has asked. So I claimed first dibs.
She did.
Isn't it risky to publish a biography when your subject still has years to go in his career?
Well, that's one reason, of course, that we did the second edition, that he kept going and doing so many things.
I should probably have stopped right after the book came out just to make your life easier.
No, I'm happy you didn't. There's lots to tell.
So how much have you added in this updated version?
Well, there's 4 new chapters and some updated material throughout. And then I got very brave and I asked Alan Menken if he would write the foreword. And he agreed to do it. He wrote a wonderful 10-page foreword. So.
Which provides a whole new perspective.
It does.
Because it's the perspective of a collaborator.
Yes, and he's worked with Stephen on 4 projects, so he had a lot to say.
So, Stephen, you had no reservations when Carol approached you?
I did have a few, but when Carol told me what her approach was going to be, which was essentially, as she put it, a creative biography. That is, it wasn't going to go, you know, poking around in the dark corners of my life, but instead talk about the work. And more interesting to me, and what I like so much about the book that Carol ultimately wrote, is that she talks a lot about the process.
Creative process.
Yeah,
exactly. How things get done.
Yeah, and I really admire that, and I haven't really read other biographies that have done that.
So did you think that you might get some perspective on your own life in the process of
it is,
on this?
Yes, and I have. It is, it's like drowning and watching your life pass before your eyes. Carol now knows more about me than I know about myself, and sometimes when someone's asked me a question and I don't know the answer as to exactly when that happened, I can call Carol and say, like, when was that? And she'll be like, oh, yeah, that was 1976.
Carol, in my experience in talking to artists, one of the things that they all think a lot about is process. So you can even talk to a novelist about working on a book that nobody's read, because it's really about how they came to write the book.
Yeah, and that's so much of my interest. And one of the things that I found really helpful, I got this advice early on, is that when you're writing a book, you want to have one key question that you're asking that everything kind of is wrapped around that, everything responds to that. And for me, I really wanted to know, how does Stephen Schwartz create? What can I learn about that, and then how can I use that information to help me create?
Do you think it was unique, or doesn't he pretty much create the way other people who do similar things?
Well, I didn't actually know how other people, I didn't know really how successful people did it. And, of course, by then he already had a great track record.
But one of the things that you did, Carol, which I really like, is ultimately you spoke with other people also about their processes, and you've included some of that in the creativity notes that you have sprinkled throughout the book. And I actually learned something from hearing what other people had to say.
On the other hand, do you feel like you're giving out advice that you wish you had gotten when you started?
Absolutely. Yeah, totally. I mean, a lot of this book and its point of view. The other thing I really like about the book is that it deals a lot, at least as much with failure as it does with success, and at least as much with obstacles and disappointment as with, triumphs and exaltation. And I feel as if so many biographies that I've encountered really, you know, the subject sort of leaps from pinnacle to pinnacle like a mountain goat. Mm-hmm. And Carol explored a lot of the valleys as well.
Because the big surprise of the story, and perhaps it applies to a lot of artists, is we assume after all of the initial success at a very early age that things just went up and up and up. And then, as we will discover as we talk about the story,
it didn't really work that way.
Didn't work that way, although you kept on recovering. So let's get to the story. Where did you grow up?
I am a Long Island Jewish boy and grew up basically in a town. Literally, I grew up in a development of Roslyn Heights, which was called South Park. So I am a an ex-South Parker, and just went
your connection to animation.
If only I'd known then, I could have gotten started a lot sooner. And then I went to Mineola High School, which is public high school, smack dab in the middle of Nassau County.
And was yours a musical family?
Not at all. No.
How old were you when you started playing the piano?
Well, I was very I was a musical kid. The music gene, as we know, presents early. It's inherited. You know, I can't really take any more credit for it than I can for my eye color. But it shows up very early if a kid is going to be musical, hence the large number of musical prodigies. And so my parents, who, although they were not musical or in the entertainment industry in any way, were fans. I mean, there was always music playing in the house, and they were concert goers, etc. So they identified early on that I responded strongly to music.
And obviously encouraged you. You went to Juilliard while you were in high school.
Yeah.
You took special classes there?
Yeah, there's a preparatory division of Juilliard, which I believe still exists, for high school kids and younger, actually. And I was fortunate enough to get a scholarship there when I was 12, my freshman year in high school. And so I went for the 4 years that I was in high school.
Did it come easily to you? Last week, I interviewed jazz pianist Kenny Werner, who said he never had to practice until he attended a conservatory where his peers were all gifted.
I think music, yes. The short answer is yes. I sort of always had music inside me. I was a bit lazy about piano technique, to be honest, until later in life. And to some extent, I regret that I wasn't more rigorous when I was younger. But music just was always flowing around in my head.
And then what's the relationship to musical theater? Do you remember the first show you saw?
I can tell you that story. It is in Carol's book rather vividly and amusingly described. My parents happened to live next door in South Park to a composer whose name was George Kleinsinger, and who had written a couple of successful, what we would now call concept albums, including Tubby the Tuba, which was very popular.
Oh, I owned that.
Well, there you go. That was George Kleinsinger. And he also wrote, as a concept album, an musical adaptation of the Archie and Mehitabel stories of Don Marquis, which had been published in The New Yorker. And it was successful enough that they were turning it into a Broadway show. And occasionally we would go over to George's house, and he would play whatever song he was working on. And then I am told, although I don't specifically remember it, that when he finished, I would go over to the piano and pick out the tune. And it was what led George to say to my parents after a couple of occasions of this, maybe you should consider getting Stephen a piano. And so that's how I started playing piano, taking lessons. Subsequently, I went to the show when it finally briefly ran on Broadway.
But then there's still a leap to deciding to make a career in the arts.
Well, I made that leap right after I saw what was Shinbone Alley on Broadway. As many people who wind up going into theater, and especially musical theater, do, I think you have that moment of falling in love. And it's usually at first sight. And my first sight of musical theater was that show, and that was it for me.
You also skipped a couple of grades in school?
I did.
No, I went through the SPs here in Brooklyn, and it ruined my life for years because when I went to college, I was younger than everybody else. I was always younger than everybody
else. Me too. Now I'm older than everybody else, but at the time I was younger than everybody else. It's interesting you said that, Leonard, because it did present some problems, particularly sort of social adjustment problems, because you're at an entirely different stage, you know, at that time of your life than other kids who are 2 years older than you are. But I can't say I regret, moving through school more quickly than I might otherwise have done.
And did you do theater when you were in high school?
I did. I was a member of a thespian troupe, I believe 276 or 476.
As an actor?
I did, yes. I was a terrible actor, but nevertheless, I did make appearances. I played Mr. Frank in The Diary of Anne Frank with some nice white shoe polish in my hair. And I was also allowed to direct a show. So I directed a production of Agatha Christie's And Then There Were None, where I restored the ending of the novel where everybody dies instead of allowing two of them to survive.
What led you to attend Carnegie Mellon University? Isn't it primarily an engineering school?
No, actually it has a really famous theater school. And the truth is, I didn't really know about it. And again, Carol deals with this in the book. This is an example of failure. I applied to Harvard and Yale, and I didn't get into either of them after having been told, oh, you have high board scores, you're going to get in whenever you apply. I didn't. And so.
Because you were so young?
Who knows? Yes, maybe. Or maybe in the interview, they just sensed I wasn't a good fit for them. You know, my son went to Harvard years later, and so I finally got to experience a Harvard graduation, though not my own. But the point is that I was now, almost ready to graduate high school, and I had not gotten into college. And my dad was doing some work for the then New York World's Fair, the 64 World's Fair. And one of the pavilions that he was doing some work for had been designed by the famous set designer Joe Miles Zener. And one day he was talking to Joe's assistants about his son who was interested in theater but had not gotten into college. And they said, oh, he should look into Carnegie Mellon. And so I applied there and got in.
Carol, Stephen went to college in the 1960s. Have you detected any counterculture influences, social or musical?
Well, he once said that Carnegie was the 60s squared, meaning it was really very much the rebellion scene. And likewise, I was in Madison, Wisconsin, and I was a hippie flower child, and I think one of the reasons why I like Stephen's music is that we listen to some of the same the musicians when we were both young. So there was, at first for Stephen was the Motown influence, but then we both listened to the singer-songwriters, especially Joni Mitchell was a big favorite of mine, and Paul Simon and James Taylor and people like that. And some of Stephen's musical theater sound was actually sculpted by those singer-songwriters, as well as by some of the folk music that we had both heard. Peter, Paul, and Mary was popular, Kingston Trio, people like that, that we both heard from our parents, I think. And so some of that influences his musical theater style, I think.
I'm speaking with Carol DeGere, who is the author of a biography called Defying Gravity, and with us is the subject of that biography, Stephen Schwartz. This is Leonard Lopate at Large on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM. Did you feel liberated in college? Did you feel that it was a good time to experiment?
I did. I felt completely liberated in college when I got to this wide open environment, you know, from my relatively conservative Long Island public school, high school. And, you know, suddenly I was there and there were all these artsy types. I mean, it's the school that Andy Warhol had graduated from some years before I was there. But, you know, there were painters and architects and designers and theater majors. And, you know, I remember that, you know, I could indulge in all these affectations. And during my freshman year, for some reason, I wound up like always wearing a cape everywhere I went. So that's...
Well, other people were wearing suits.
Right. The engineers were wearing suits and I was walking around in a cape and, you know, like some silly floppy hat.
And what was the Scotch and Soda Musical Club?
Ah, that was a great experience and influence for me. There was an extracurricular organization at Carnegie called Scotch and Soda, very collegiate name, that produced an original musical every year. And I learned about this during freshman orientation and signed up and was lucky enough to get, after auditioning some songs, to become one of the co-writers of the show. And I wound up writing the show or co-writing the show all 4 years that I was there. And the third year, my junior year, the show was called Pippin Pippin, and it was the precursor of what became Pippin.
There was What's Her Face.
Yes, the first one was called What's Her Face, which was a very Carol Burnett-y story about a washerwoman who becomes, you know, a famous model. The second one was called Nouveau, which was about the New York art scene, even though those of us writing it knew absolutely nothing about the New York art scene. Then Pippin Pippin, and then my fourth show was a terrible one-act opera called Voltaire and the Witches, which was all about the conflict between the Apollonian and Dionysian modes of thought.
Ooh.
Again, very, very collegiate.
Now, you were writing both the music and writing the lyrics?
I started out...
Because you were trained as a musician. Yeah. Did the lyrics just come?
Well, I started out just writing the music, and there was a lyricist for What's Her Face, who was at the time named Iris Ratner, but actually grew up to be Iris Raynor Dart, who wrote the novel Beaches, among other bestsellers. But then gradually, after Iris graduated, I started to find that other lyricists were not really doing the storytelling that I thought that the shows needed, and I started just out of self-defense writing lyrics myself.
So, did they come easily?
No, they were
because you know,
they
you know,
don't.
The cliche question is, what came first, the lyrics or the music? I would assume in your case it was the music.
Well, now it isn't so much. Now it goes back and forth. But yes, at the time it was. But lyrics, I still find challenging. I sort of say that music is an art in that it sort of just flows. Lyrics are a craft, and it's sort of like the difference between painting and making pottery.
Well, it's like you can sit down at the piano and let your fingers go freely, but when you sit down with a piece of paper, that doesn't happen. You
actually exactly
have to figure out what you're going to write. So you say Pippin, you did Pippin. How did that inspire any professional interest?
Yes, what happened was I got a letter my senior year from a young man in, well, I didn't know he was a young man, but from a guy in New York saying that he was a producer and he had heard the little album that we had made of Pippin Pippin and thought it had promise and would I be interested in developing it after I graduated from college. And I, you know, leapt at the chance, and turned out he wasn't actually a producer. And he lived in one of those, you know, sixth floor walk-ups down in the Alphabet City where the bathtub doubled as the dining room table.
Yeah.
It was sort of glamorous like that. But nevertheless, you know, I won't tell the extended story, but it is in Defying Gravity. Through that contact, I ultimately got an agent who ultimately brought me two real producers, one of whom turned out to be Stuart Ostro, who produced the show.
So, Carol, do you think that Stephen's time in college is a key to understanding the later development?
Well, I think there's lots of keys.
Because he also studied being a director and doing other things.
Yeah. I think more of a key is his interest in storytelling. I mean, and one of the things he talks about his college experience is that he took some acting training. And he's, I think, don't you find now that when you're working with some writers, they don't necessarily know what it means to be an actor, and there's something about acting where it's like you're stepping into the character. And wasn't that important
yes,
for your
I
musical
think that's
theater
accurate.
Training?
Yeah, especially right. My senior year there, they brought a guy down named John Ulmer, who was a disciple of Sandy Meisner and mm-hmm. the Neighborhood Playhouse. And that was revelatory to me in terms of what you need as an actor in order to bring something to life. So even though I was and remain a really terrible actor, I understood what actors needed, and it very much influenced how I write.
And directed, I assume.
Yeah, I mean, I was
a director. You've won an award as a director.
I have, but the director in my family is my son, Scott, who's a far better director than I. The reason that I was a directing major in school, frankly, was because you got to take everything. If you were a writing major, playwriting major, it was quite limited, but as a director, I could take, you know, scenic design and stagecraft and acting and history of the theater, and I wanted to learn as much as I could.
But then when you left school, you worked as a producer at RCA Records.
Was
that the job that was available?
I was very fortunate to get that job since I had absolutely no experience and really not much skill. But it was the time when the record companies were recognizing this new sound, and the executives were of an age that they didn't really understand it.
So that's when Columbia signed Bob Dylan, and after having been years of being very legit and very classic musically oriented.
Exactly right. It was the turnover to whatever you want to call it, pop.
RCA had
rock.
Elvis.
Yeah, but Elvis is sort of a different era. Mm-hmm. You know, this was when they were starting to find the groups and sounds that became, you know, the rock music of the 70s.
But you were very young. Do you think part of your appeal was that they thought you might give them an insight into what younger audiences wanted?
I think that was my entire appeal, because it certainly could not have been my vast experience, which didn't exist.
It was just so fortunate, though, that he had that, because ever since he's been producing his own cast albums, pretty much, except for maybe the Godspell movie. But
no,
most,
I did that too.
Okay,
yeah.
So working with Elliot and
it was
on.
Very, very helpful to me to learn so much about the studio. I basically learned about the recording studio on RCA's dime.
And then you also played in a rock band for a short time?
I did, yes. Not a very good rock band.
What instrument? Piano.
Well, I did keyboards and not very good vocals.
So how did you come to write the title song for the Broadway play Butterflies Are Free? You were still very young.
Yeah, I was 21. My agent was Shirley Bernstein, who was Leonard Bernstein's sister, and this was the agent that I acquired while auditioning Pippin around. And
that's That was a good connection.
It was a very good connection.
Leonard Bernstein?
Yeah, it served me well in a couple of years later. But she also represented the actor Keir DeLay, mm-hmm. who had appeared in this original production of this show called Butterflies Are Free, in which he played a blind folk singer. And they needed a song that he had written. And she sent me the script and said, why don't you write a song and submit it on spec? And I did, and it was chosen. And I was then paid the princely royalty of $25 a week, which to me was amazing for the Broadway run.
Are you still getting royalties on that?
Actually, I am, because they made it into a very successful movie, and which shows up on television every now and then.
How did you come to work on Godspell? You're a Jewish boy. Did that?
Well, among the producers for whom Shirley, or to whom Shirley took me to audition the score for Pippin, were Edgar Lansbury and Joe Beru. And they were not interested in Pippin, but about, Carol, you know the chronology better than I, but several months later, out of the blue, I got a phone call from their office saying that there was this show off Broadway at the Cafe La Mama called, I think it was called The Godspell at the time, and that they felt it had commercial potential but needed a score. Would I be interested in writing it?
And did it help that you weren't there from the beginning, that you could be a member of the audience and try to figure out what would go well where?
It helped enormously. And the other thing that helped, as you pointed out, my being, you know, a Long Island Jewish boy, was I really didn't know these stories. I mean, obviously I knew the Jesus story because it's an American story, so everybody knows that now in America. But I didn't know all those parables. I'd never heard, you know, the prodigal son, and I'd heard of Good Samaritans, but I didn't know that parable, etc. So seeing this, I could really respond, just as you say, Leonard, you know, as an audience member, and be able to say, this works, that one not so much.
One of the interesting things about it is he was able to actually see a version of the show at La Mama, and so he could tell what worked and didn't work. But also, I think one thing he brought his talent, Stephen is particularly good at developing songs that have a build. So a lot of the songs that had been in there at La Mama were just pop songs that kind of stayed in the same tempo. And
so they threw them all out?
All but one.
Stephen knows how, like, Bless the Lord is a great example of a song that starts and keeps growing and growing, and the audience gets so excited by the end. It's.
Were you collaborating, or was this all just you providing songs for something that was already there?
Well, I collaborated with the director who had conceived the show, John Michael Teblak.
The reason I ask, Carol, is why do you think Stephen usually works so well with his collaborators?
Why does he work well?
There were rocky events as well, but...
directors. I always get along with the writers.
Yeah, I think he's a good partner with writers. Well, again, I think in this industry, you're telling a story. And in this case, you're telling it with music. But I think Stephen has a really good sense of storytelling. So you're sitting down and you're figuring out what do I want people to, what's the arc of the story? What's being told over time? And so he's not someone who's just going, I was surprised, actually. I thought he'd just sit in his corner at the piano and write some songs. But he's involved in every aspect of finding out what the story is that you want to present on stage.
And then when a show opens, at least traditionally, I don't know, is it still a case? There was the opening party at Sardi's where you waited for the review from the Times and the other papers?
Well, now the problem is that everything's online, and so it destroys the opening night party. But yes, but at the time, that's exactly what happened. We would go to Sardi's, and around 11 o'clock, the reviews would start coming in.
And most of the reviews were good, but not the Times.
No, actually, that's a funny story, which Carol details in her book, too. So I won't go into it at too much length here. But yes, the first review we got was the Times review, which was negative.
Who wrote it?
Carol? Clive Barnes.
Oh, yeah. Well.
I've never actually gotten a good review in the New York Times for any theater piece that I've ever done. So now I'm just used to it. But at the time, it was pretty devastating. But then the rest of the reviews were very good. And, you know, consequently, the Times review didn't turn out to matter so much.
So you had word of mouth and, as I said, praise from all the other reviewers. But word of mouth is a key factor in a show, isn't it?
Completely. And it's becoming more and more that way with the power of the Internet and people posting their own reviews and ideas, which I actually think is a welcome thing.
You think the Times has something against you? They have always given you lukewarm reviews. In fact, they didn't give you a rave for Wicked,
yeah,
and here
like
you are 30 years later Wicked.
Yeah, they didn't like Wicked either. I don't think it's personal at all. I think it's a sensibility. I think, you know, the kind of work that I do, and in a lot of ways the kind of work that I like is not to the taste of the New York Times theater critics for whatever reason. I used to worry about this a lot, and I no longer worry about it.
You're listening to Leonard Lopate at Large.
Something has changed within me. Something is not the same. I'm through with playing by the rules of someone else's game. Too late for second guessing. Too late to go back to sleep. It's time to trust my instincts. Close my eyes and leave.
I'm talking with Carol DeGeer, the biographer of Stephen Schwartz, about Defying Gravity, the biography she has written of him. This is Leonard Lopate at Large on WBAI New York. And as you probably know, WBAI doesn't accept advertising or corporate underwriting of any kind. We rely totally on the financial support of our listeners. Now, Broadway shows have angels. So if you want to keep this and all of the BAI shows that you enjoy on the air, we hope that you will become a WBAI angel and give us a call right now to make a donation. Please give it whatever amount that you're comfortable with. It all helps to bring you these one-hour deep dive interviews that I loved on the show. And if you become a sustaining member of Leonard Lopate at Large at the monthly sustaining level of $10 or more, we'd be happy to say thank you with a free one-year subscription to Mother Jones, one of the leading progressive publications with a focus on political commentary and investigative reporting. It's our way of saying thanks for supporting Leonard Lopate at Large, and your donation will automatically be deducted from your checking or credit card account. So give us a call now, 516-620-3602, or go to give2wbai.org. That's give and then the number 2wbai.org. And please be sure to note that your membership is in the name of Leonard Lopate at Large. And again, that number is 516-620-3602, or give2wbai.org. And thanks for supporting WBAI and Leonard Lopate at Large. And we're back with Stephen Schwartz and Carol DeGeer. Stephen, did the success of Godspell make Pippin more producible?
Well, actually, Pippin had already been optioned by Stuart Ostro, and we were in the process of getting the show ready for Broadway. It did allow us to get Bob Fosse as director.
Also, you collaborated with Roger O. Herson, but that seems like an odd collaboration in a way, both in terms of generation and background.
Yeah, well, my agent, Shirley Bernstein, and I were looking for a book writer for Pippin, And Roger was the client of another agent at the agency Shirley was at the time. And so he was recommended, and this agent, Marion Sertschinger, gave me a couple of his plays to read. And I liked their sort of, they were kind of absurdist and quirky and dark humor, and that felt right to me. So
he took Pippin onto another level.
Yeah, he certainly did. Yeah, yeah, he had great ideas.
Carol, you called the chapter on that production Schwartz versus Fozzie. How contentious was the relationship? I'm afraid to ask Stephen.
Yeah, well, he'll have some stories, but I want to be sure to mention that in the second edition, I include notes about the Broadway revival, and because Stephen had trouble with Fosse, but things changed over the years, and his perspective was different, and there was this wonderful Broadway revival, so I wanted to include information about that in the book.
But initially, Stephen is still very young. Was it a fair fight, given their relative positions in the industry?
Well, Fosse wanted to use his position of he was already quite famous, and apparently he worked autocratically. Would you say that, Stephen?
He barred you from rehearsals.
They keep saying that, and I guess he did, but I don't really remember that. Yes, it was a very contentious relationship. I had just come off doing Godspell, where I pretty much, you know, had my way in collaboration, of course, but there was never any sort of disagreement. It was all this group of kids putting on a show, like, you know, Mickey and Judy in a barn. And I thought Broadway was going to be like that, and it's not at all. And of course, that's not how Bob worked. I think, you know, I was so young and so inexperienced, but I was also, you know, this fairly arrogant kid. I think, you know, now, obviously, if I were dealing with somebody like Bob, I would have a much easier time with that collaboration.
Had hiring Ben Vereen changed Bob Fosse's idea about the show? Didn't he start reshaping it?
Well, he had already reshaped it a great deal. But we all were very enthusiastic when we discovered Ben, which was somebody that Bob brought in, and we all were happy to rebuild the show around Ben and kind of create a character for him.
Then you had to alter the songs so that you could get more dancing in.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, but that always happens. I think the issue with Bob was not so much that we were altering and developing the show, that's just part of what you do, but that our point of view and our taste was very different in a lot of ways.
He didn't consult with you when he did all that jazz.
He did not consult with me at all, and I was enormously relieved not to be a character in it.
What was the inspiration for the magic show? Could Doug Hemming sing?
Not at all. Not a single note. Basically, the producers of Godspell, Edgar and Joe, were up in Toronto producing a revival of Gypsy, and they went and saw this kid, Doug Henning, doing a magic act, and were very impressed with his theatricality. And they phoned me and said, listen, we know you always like magic. You're always writing songs with magic in the title. Come up and see this kid and see if you think there's a show there. And I did, but of course the sort of trick of it, if you will pardon the pun, was how to write a show where the leading character, a musical in which the leading character never sings.
And as a professional magician, he'd been used to working alone and having the final say on everything. Were there any conflicts with him as a collaborator?
No, actually not. Doug was great to work with. And that was a pretty fun and easy collaboration.
Were other shows you did informed by the show? Did the magic in it play a role in your thinking about Wicked?
I've always liked magic, and I learned a lot about how it gets done doing the magic show, which I will say was actually disappointing when you find out how they do things. So halfway through working on the magic show, I stopped going in to find out how things were done, because it was always such a letdown.
Oh, but, or else you could have become a magician on your own.
I'm not
you knew
not
all
sure
the tricks.
I'm not sure I have the skill though for to. And Doug was enormously facile. He did a lot of prestidigitation, mm-hmm. where he did, you know, like quick things with his hands, and which he'd practiced for years and years and years. And I don't have those skills.
But go ahead, Karen.
Stephen wrote some amazing songs for that that were then used in cabarets a lot, Lion Tamer, and also West End Avenue. I had a chance to interview Dale Soles, who was Doug's assistant. She had to be the one to twist up and hide inside trunks and things
like
that.
Don't tell.
It was fascinating, but unfortunately, this is one of the things I had to learn as a biographer. You're going to interview someone for an hour, hour and a half, and you may only be able to use a couple of sentences, if that. And so part of the process, creative process, of course, is learning when to let go. And I had to let go of some of those great stories for the second edition. But in the first edition, there's
and this
some
is
more
not
Dale
a thin
story.
Book.
Yeah, well, this is 512 pages.
You devote a section of the book to the years that followed The Magic Show, 1974 to 1991. And we mentioned earlier that there were years of struggle and professional disappointment.
Yes, he had his second act, that I call it. So
the first there was The Baker's Wife, which started with a lunch with Neil Simon. You would think that would have been a monster hit.
Well, yes, except Neil Simon didn't wind up doing it, though another wonderful writer, Joseph Stein, did wind up doing the show. But, yeah, it was one of those shows that just had, you know, this torturous out-of-town lengthy run where people kept getting fired, and it was, yeah, one of those proverbial things that led somebody to say that, you know, if he could punish one of the great villains of history, it would be by having them be out of town with the musical in trouble.
And with Topol doing the starring role.
Exactly.
But the cast album became a big hit, despite the fact that it never made it to Broadway.
That is true, and gave the show a big life, ultimately. Thereafter, the first of a few shows of mine that have failed initially but gone on to have happy afterlives.
Well, you seem to be attracted to unorthodox projects. For example, making Studs Terkel's book Working into a musical. Now, you're creating a nonfiction musical in that case.
Yeah, it's a documentary musical. I think I was somewhat influenced by A Chorus Line, which I very much admired and which had preceded Working. And so I was interested in the whole idea of, as I say, a documentary musical. And I came across the book and I was fascinated by shining a spotlight on people, characters, careers that normally we are invisible to us.
And you encouraged the cast to be part of the creative process.
Absolutely. And we did workshops where they would bring in ideas of how to theatricalize the interviews.
How did James Taylor become involved in that?
I asked him. Mm-hmm. I went around and I became aware fairly early in the process of developing Working that for me to write the entire score meant that I was going to be basically writing pastiche a lot of the time and imitating other writers in order to get the authentic voice for the characters. And it occurred to me, in the interests of authenticity, to go to the people who wrote that way and invite them, one of whom was James.
And it was a failure, which is got to be embarrassing because it's in public.
Oh, yes. Theatrical failure is extremely embarrassing, and you feel like, you know, you're walking down the street with a big black mark on your head and everybody's looking at you, which, of course, is not true, but it feels that way from the inside.
Did it help you at least that you won a Drama Desk Best Director Award for Working?
A little bit, but I was pretty burned out by that point with the experience with Baker's Wife and Working, and Working had not yet had the resuscitation that it has subsequently had. And that was my period of sort of retreating from the world, which Carol also writes about.
But then you wind up working on animated films.
Yeah, well, that was many years later, Leonard. But yeah, I was fortunate enough to get a call from Alan Menken, who was a friend of mine. Mm-hmm. You know, we played tennis together and kind of knew each other because we live up near each other upstate. And he had lost his longtime writing partner, Howard Ashman, to AIDS and was looking for a collaborator. This was during his heyday at Disney. And I had actually gone back to school to get a degree in psychology. And I thought, well, I've done my theater show business thing, and now I'm going to pursue this other career. And then Alan and subsequently Disney called, and that was the end of my career as a psychologist.
But you had to change your approach. After all, you had been a composer, lyricist, and now you were being asked to just write the lyrics. Was it difficult for you to separate the two?
Not really, to be honest. I had a little bit of experience working with Leonard Bernstein on the Bernstein Mass and on an unsuccessful Broadway show called Rags, where Charles Strauss wrote the music. So I had done collaboration. Alan and I just sort of hit it off and developed a process very quickly of how we would collaborate. Basically, we would work music first, and consequently, because I had the music, I'd go home and I would play it over and over again on the piano, you know, as I was developing the lyrics, and it just became, you know, I internalized the music. It didn't really matter who had written it. It was just the music, and so, yeah, also liked the music.
One of the things that Alan also says is that when people say, do you do music or lyrics first? And he says, you start with the assignment. And so really your plot, you're figuring out in the whole arc of the story where these songs need to be and what they need to cover, what the characters are expressing. And don't you also usually start with the title, Stephen?
Yeah.
So that like crystallizes what you're doing.
It does, for both me and for Alan.
I would assume that there's something frustrating in having, you might very well have written different music for your own lyrics.
I would have, but
do you ever sit down at the piano and do your version?
No, it was really, you have to believe me, Leonard, it was really not frustrating. I liked the work with Alan. I liked the music to which I was setting lyrics, and that was, it just wasn't the job, so I didn't worry about it. The job was to do this collaboration, and I enjoyed it.
And did you imagine that your career was going to be in animated films from then on? Because you did, you worked on The Prince of Egypt, although that I think
that I
cost
did do
you,
music and lyrics for, yeah.
But that cost you Mulan.
It did, yes. I got fired from Disney for
going to DreamWorks.
The betrayal of going to do a job with DreamWorks. With DreamWorks. But yes, I was having a very happy Hollywood career and enjoying that, and you know, away from the exigencies and miseries of Broadway. And then someone told me about this book called Wicked.
But after you won an Oscar for Pocahontas, did you imagine that you'd ever return to Broadway?
No, I had no intention of writing for theater again. I was very happy out there in Hollywood doing the movies.
When you worked for Disney, you could do research by traveling to where the story took place. Well, for Wicked, how do you research Oz?
Yeah, if only. Wouldn't that have been nice if we could all have gotten in a little house and been blown by cyclone there? But unfortunately, that no matter how much I waited for the cyclone, that didn't happen.
Pippin had been inspired a little by The Lion in Winter. Do you see an element of Rosencrantz and Guildenstern in Wicked?
Completely. Rosencrantz and Guildenstern is so influential on me, the Tom Stoppard play. I feel like I very frequently do something based on that idea of taking a familiar story or familiar characters and spinning it and coming at it from another point of view. And Wicked is, you know, clearly heavily influenced by that Rosencrantz and Guildenstern technique.
But I'd imagine the structures and demands of a play and a novel are so different that doing an adaptation might be difficult in deciding what you'd keep in and what you'd have to leave out.
Well, that was one of the most amazing things, that Stephen had actually read the novel before he started working with Winnie or with Mark Platt, the producer. He really went through the novel and conceived, how do you take a 405-page novel and make it into a 2.5-hour show? And he wrote an outline, and I actually include the outline that he wrote in the back of the book. Mm. And then he brought that in the first meetings. And it changed a little bit from there. Winnie had her own contribution of making Galinda a more of a character, a stronger character but the basic concepts of, didn't you think of how the musical was going to start? That was one of the very first things you intuited when you read the
Yeah, I mean, full credit to Winnie and Mark. The outline changed a great deal in its specifics, but structurally, it really didn't change very much. With the opening, the end of the first act, and the end of the show pretty much were there in that original outline.
The idea of defying gravity. When would there be a defying gravity moment?
Yeah.
Was the process easier because you were older and more experienced?
Way easier, yeah. This whole process is so much easier for me now. Really having learned how to collaborate, I think, has been significant in my development.
So the show's been a monster hit. What did the Times not like about it?
You know, honestly...
That wasn't Clive Barnes.
No. This is Ben Brantley. I can't honestly tell you because I don't read reviews. Uh-huh. So all I knew was that they didn't like it.
How many productions have there been of Wicked worldwide?
Oh, gosh. We're running in several productions all over the world. It hasn't been released yet for stock and amateur productions or productions other than these major first-class ones. But we've been, we're still running in England and in Germany and Japan, and it's been in South Korea and in
15 countries, 100 cities. That was one reason why.
See, I told you, Carol knows more about it than I do.
Another motivation for doing a second edition is that I had finished my research in 2007, and we didn't know quite how amazingly successful Wicked would be around the world. And one of the things we didn't know is, would it translate to different cultures? And I think Stephen's story of working with translators is quite fascinating, so I wanted to include that. That's in chapter 30 now.
Yeah, I mean, we talk a lot about how you how to work with translators, and also how
The lyrics of the songs as well as the script.
Oh yeah, no, that's mostly it's mostly the lyrics. The script is a relatively straightforward translation, but the lyrics have to fit this pre-existing music, and they have to rhyme, and they have to be singable, and it's a complicated process to do it in Finnish and Korean, etc.
German.
So are you happy with those versions?
I am. It's pretty labor intensive, but I always try to work with the translators because you can't do a literal translation, and some of the song titles just have no, they only mean something in English. That one of the song For Good in English has a double meaning, obviously, both for the good and permanently. That double meaning exists in no other language, so you have to find substitutes.
An interesting development in Broadway shows in recent years is the jukebox musical. I counted five so far, and they're all hits, or most of them are hits. We have Frankie Valli with the Jersey Boys. We have Carole King. We have ABBA, the Dixie Chicks, and now Cher.
Donna Summer, the Temptations are coming.
Okay, so have composer lyricists like you become somewhat superfluous? Is this a way of getting around having to create a whole new show?
It's very interesting you should say that. That form is not my favorite as a composer lyricist. I don't think that's the reason for them. I think the reason for them is that there's a built-in audience. Mm-hmm. And consequently, it's a less risky investment, but I do find it a bit discouraging that there are so many of them, to be honest.
And also, they're all aimed at certain demographics, whereas when you're writing something like Wicked, I'm sure you weren't thinking, oh, this will really go over well with people between 35 and 55.
No, absolutely. That is true. But, yeah, I mean, it's an economic reality.
So have new projects come your way?
Oh gosh, yeah. I'm working on a lot of things, as I've been saying to friends who've been asking. I'm throwing a lot of spaghetti at the wall and seeing what sticks and what slithers off. But I have a couple of movie projects I'm developing. I mean, the things I can talk about are the movie of Wicked is moving along and I think is getting close to starting to go into pre-production, and a stage adaptation of Prince of Egypt is pretty far advanced. And
so you've gone both ways. You've done Broadway shows that became animated films and animated films that have become
Broadway shows. And then I have some a few original projects.
The Hunchback of Notre Dame was, which is one of Stephen's favorite scores of Allen's. They decided to make a stage musical of it, and it's one of the more popular musicals now, licensed by Musical Theater International.
So playing that's around the world.
In addition to this book, Carol, haven't you done one about the production of Godspeed?
I did one on Godspell. And I'm considering one on Pippin because I like the focus of that show.
I thank you both so much for being on our show. We've been talking with Stephen Schwartz about a biography of him called Defying Gravity, written by Carol DeGeer, has also been here. It is published by, it's a huge book, a paperback.
has pictures, though.
With lots of pictures. Published by Applause Theater and Cinema Books. Thank you so much, both of you.
It's really been a pleasure to talk with you.
And people can meet us online at stephenschwartz.com and caroldegere.com.
And isn't there a... I understand there's also a digital version of the book that's
there will be, not yet. But.
So that brings us to the end of the show. My great thanks to Stephen Schwartz and Carol DeGere, to Fran Higgins, who produced this segment, to my producer, Jesse Lent, who was at the audio controls today, to Charlie Morrow, who composed our theme music, and to Kevin O'Donohue, Nasima, and Alex Gomez of the Positive Mind Center for allowing us to use their wonderful broadcast facility today. Leonard Lopate at Large comes to you on Saturdays at 4 and Tuesdays at noon. You can subscribe to Leonard Lopate at Large podcast on iTunes and by clicking on Robin Hood Radio's archive program site, which is robinhoodradio.com. You can also check out Leonard Lopate at Large Facebook page. We hope to see you next week.